déjà redécouvert. Et maintenant, vous avez dit des cinq hier. C'est une minute.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. We have two items to deal with. It's going to be briefing by the Department of Public Works on Phase 3 of the expanded public works program. And the second item is consideration of the committee legacy report. Like I stated, we need to leave a report behind. From 9:30 to 12 o'clock, it will be EPWP, and then from 12 to 1:00, it will be a legacy report. Is it fine, Honourable Member? Election time. Election time. Premier candidate, by the way. Are you premier candidate?
It's okay, but I'll have to leave a couple of slides for the report.
Okay. Is that all? Are there any apologies? There are four apologies. One from Honorable Stolle, Gayla, Mr. Henderson, and the Minister. Let's start with our meeting. Oh, and the DG, who was on sick leave, ne? Okay. Without waiting, any words of time, I'd like to request the Deputy Minister to...
Yes, thank you. Good morning, and thank you, Chairperson. First of all, just to signal that the presentation we'll make is slightly different. It's essentially the same presentation as the one that we circulated late last week to the committee, but we've refined it a little bit, and we have redistributed it in hard copy form this morning. So apologies for the changes, but it's work in progress, as you understand. Secondly, just explain that, that as we're presenting it from the ministry, this particular report, normally one would get a report from officials in the department, but we're talking now about phase three, in other words, from going forward now to the new financial year and over 5 years. And this has been rather more of a political process from the side of cabinet, basically. So what one's talking to essentially is broader than the Department of Public Works, because obviously the expanded public works and community work programs are also more than just DPW expanded public works programs. But as I'll explain later, the cabinet decision of November last year was to move towards the establishment of a presidential coordinating commission for public employment programs, and the DPW is envisaged as playing a key role in terms of the technical secretarial support. Okay, so in a sense, it's getting ready for that in the new administration, essentially, where we will have a key role technically to support a program which is much wider, obviously, and has always been much wider than just the Department of Public Works. Okay, so then let's move into the actual presentation. We can skip over the outline. It's a couple of slides which just are chapter headings, as it were, and go to the background and origins. We think it's important as we now look to scale up significantly that we think that we don't just plunge ahead with a new set of plans, but we try to reflect on what we've learned and where we're coming from in terms of these expanded public works and public employment programs. So the first point that we make is that the reconstruction and development program of 1994, interestingly, called for a coordinated public works program to provide much needed infrastructure to repair environmental damage and link back into the industrial and agricultural base. And it's envisaged that this coordinated effort in terms of public employment programs would be coordinated by a national coordinating agency located in the implementing office of the RDP. And so you can see that where we're trying to go now as we move forward into the next 5 years, we're in a sense going back to what was the germ of a very important idea, that these public employment programs needed a coordinating capacity, which has been a bit lacking over the last period. Unfortunately, this idea of a national coordinated agency, as envisaged in the RDP of 1994, it got sidelined with the closing of what was then the RDP office. Remember, in the first administration, for the first couple of years of the first Democratic administration, there was a minister without portfolio running what was called an RDP office. And that, for a number of reasons, that didn't fly effectively, and in 1996 it was closed basically. And really, from about 1996, government's focus in terms of job creation in particular, but also poverty alleviation, was focused on getting our macroeconomic balances right and hoping through the GEAR policy, the Growth, Employment and Redistribution Policy of 1996, that with getting better macroeconomic policies in place and being effectively implemented, that we would see that was the key to the response, and that jobs would come in the formal sector, basically in the private sector. And what GEAR envisaged in 1996 was within 5 years there would be 1 million formal sector jobs. Okay, so the RDP idea got a little bit displaced in the mid-1990s, which is not to say that there weren't important beginnings of expanded public works programs of one kind or another. In particular, the Department of Public Works moved into the space of labor intensity in construction unevenly, and as we would concede later. The Department of Water Affairs, as it was then called, launched in 1995 the very interesting Working for Water program, and a number of provincial roads departments, notably KZN and a couple of others later, Limpopo, also introduced household-based maintenance of allocated stretches of rural roads, a very nice and, I think, interesting program. But these were basically fairly small programs at this stage. So the last point we make on this slide is that indeed the aspirations of GEAR were realized in terms of growth. The growth, employment and redistribution macroeconomic policies did result in growth that within the five-year period of that was envisaged and planned in GEAR. It produced growth that began to touch 5% and slightly beyond, but it didn't. Sadly and tragically, didn't result in a significant reduction or even a reduction of structural poverty, inequality, unemployment, and unemployment remained stubbornly high at 20% and above in the narrow definition and 30% and more in the wider definition. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. So it was in this context and coming out of the 2003 Growth and Development Summit that government, but with its social partners at that Growth and Development Summit, agreed that we needed to respond to the stubborn presence of unemployment and also obviously poverty and inequality with a number of interventions, and one of them that was decided at the Growth and Development Summit was a significant upscaling of expanded public works programs, or what we're calling public employment programs, basically the same thing. Okay. And so that's where phase one of the EDWP originated, and it set a target of five-year target of 1 million work opportunities. The second bullet point is making the point that if one looks back to the speeches that were made by politicians and to the policy documents at the launch of the phase one of EDWP, essentially the assumption was that the GEAR policies and other policies had resulted in an effective and stabilized and well-functioning so-called first economy. But the problem was that the legacy of apartheid had left us with a so-called informal, so-called second economy, and that what was required was a number of interventions that would enable sort of one-off ladders, step-ups from a dysfunctional, unmodernized, undeveloped second economy, a number of interventions which would enable people in the second economy to make it into the first economy. So this is where we started to see a lot of focus on small and medium enterprise development, taxi recapitalization, give them a nicely fancy taxi, and suddenly the taxi industry would be part of a formalized first economy. And the Expanded Public Works Program was seen also a little bit like that. The problem is that when young people from townships try to get a job, the first question they asked is, have you got work experience? And they had to say no, and they turned away. So the idea is give them some work experience. I think the target was a minimum of 100 days of work experience. And then next time to knock on the boss's door, they would get employment. Okay, so that was the core assumption in phase one. Obviously, I'm going on to say it was an understandable but wrong assumption, but that was the assumption. Nonetheless, phase one, despite I think its illusions about a kind of one-off step ladder from a so-called second into a so-called first economy, nonetheless, it did achieve the 1 million work opportunities target a whole year ahead of time, so within 4 years rather than 5 years by 2008. The target for work opportunities was achieved, but it didn't make a dent in the unemployment rate, and therefore also obviously in terms of poverty and inequality alleviation as well. So the phase one came to an end in 2009, but meanwhile the global economic crisis 2008 begins to impact massively on South Africa and other developing, all world economies in one form or another. So that was the context then when we reached phase two of the EPWP program, which we now have basically come to, it's now in its end state, for 2009 to 2014. Encouraged by the successes in meeting the target of 1 million work opportunities in the previous 5 years, we now set a target, a more ambitious target, of 4.5 million work opportunities for phase two. And we think that we're pretty much on target to have met that. The data is still coming in, obviously, but we think that the 4.5 million work opportunities will have been met. Phase two also interestingly saw some new developments, including the introduction of the non-state sector much more actively, the interesting community work program, which we'll talk a little bit more about. Originally run as a pilot out of presidency and then currently with the Department of Cooperative Governance. I'll talk more about what that is, but essentially it's about allowing communities with assisted by non-profit organizations to set their own work programs in their communities. And running out of the Department of Public Works is also the non-profit organization program, where we work closely with a number of non-profit organizations, community-based formations, and so on. And also we've seen the introduction of national, provincial, and municipal EPWP incentive grant to try and encourage and incentivize the use of labor-intensive and expanded public work programs in municipalities, for instance. Okay, the point that one wants to underline is that in the course of this phase two, not just in regard to these public employment programs, but more broadly, government has increasingly broken away, and I think the country's broken away from the notion of a first and second economy. It's not as though there are two economies in South Africa. There's a very polarized set of realities in South Africa, which are very evident to all of us. But it's not like there's some second economy functioning on a different currency or whatever, and then the first economy. And increasingly what we've said is the problem is the economy itself. If you want to call it the mainstream economy, has a number of systemic dysfunctionalities. We're very based on still exporting unprocessed, unbeneficiated mineral products out of our mines, and then we import them back as high-value cell phones and laptops and so on. So we create jobs in China and everywhere else, and we're not really using our mineral resources. I mean, to use one obvious example. And so the idea is that we need to get onto a new growth path, and obviously there's a document called the New Growth Path, amongst other things, which means that we've got to change the way in which the economy functions, and therefore any approach to public employment programs can't just be like an add-on. It needs to be contributing to transforming the systemic nature of the way in which the economy is not creating jobs, which is, it's often too capital intensive for all kinds of reasons and so on. Okay. I won't get into that debate more largely, but the point is that one's trying to locate phase three now of the public employment programs much more thoughtfully as part of an overall contribution to systemic changes in the way in which our society and economy function. Okay, moving on then. Now, having said all of this, and the opposition colleagues will get bored because, but I think they'll agree with us at least in this, that notwithstanding these challenges and things, there's actually just a quite an interesting, I hate to use the kind of thing, but a good story to be told. Okay. I'm not campaigning electorally now at all. I think it's a good South African story to tell. With its unevennesses and challenges and problems, I'm not trying to hide those. But, you know, there's chronic unemployment now around the world, or in many parts of the world. Like in Spain, for instance, the youth unemployment statistics are pretty much like the same as ours here in South Africa. Over 50% of young people in Spain, for instance, a developed country, are unemployed. And because of the unemployment challenges, Ignatius and Kilimoki are recently back from Cameroons, where there was a big African conference on public employment programs. That's why Stanley is ill, by the way. He ate something in Cameroons and hasn't recovered. DDG Stanley Henderson. But there's a big interest in what we're doing in South Africa in terms of this, because throughout Africa, throughout the developing world, in Latin America, governments and societies are having to look at public employment programs as not the total solution, but as one very significant solution to these huge problems of youth unemployment, unemployment in general, and so forth. And we're suddenly realizing, because the International Labour Organization and other you know, partners around Africa and other parts of the world, they're very interested in us, and we're suddenly realizing, hang on, we are not telling our own story to ourselves sufficiently inside South Africa. We mustn't prettify it, we mustn't dress it up into what it isn't, but at the same time, we think there's some very, very interesting things in South Africa, and we need to communicate these more effectively and learn from them, the good and weak points about it. So what follows are a couple of pages, a couple of slides, just talking about some of the interesting things. So first of all, what we discover is that almost like we stumbled into it, but almost uniquely in South Africa, our public employment programs cut across several sectors. So to take India, India has a brilliant public employment program. It's, what's it called? It's Mahatma Gandhi National Rural Guarantee Scheme. Okay. And basically they have 50 million people a year on the scheme, something like 50 million people. Okay. But it's very focused, and it's a single line budget item. It's run by their equivalent of our rural development department. It's seasonal, so it doesn't run through the year. Basically in India there's a harvesting season, a sowing season, and a dead season where farmers are not active, and it's a season in which there's a lot of rural poverty and desperation, hunger, starvation, and so on. So they're using their program to target that season, and without going into too much detail, basically anybody in rural municipalities who wants to work on a public employment program, and it would be digging a well or repairing, you know, the kind of infrastructure stuff that we do, they didn't build new things. They kind of, it's maintenance and rural maintenance. Anyone who, in a rural municipality, who wants to work is guaranteed a small stipend to work for during that season of 3 or 4 months. And sorry, it's 100 days. Okay. And if the municipality can't provide them with work, they're obliged to pay them in any case for the stipend. So there's an allocation to rural municipalities to do. So it's a very interesting program. It's on a huge scale, but it's one thing and 100 days in a year across India. It's just those 100 years. So we are quite different. We are running across a whole range of different sectors. Dozens of national line departments are involved in expanded public works programs of one kind or another. All provinces, all municipalities are involved in expanded public works programs. Our focus is both rural and urban, because our problems of unemployment, poverty, inequality and so on are rural, but they're also urban. So our situation, not that they're not in India as well, but obviously they've got a much bigger rural population and challenges there. So, you know, in Latin America, for instance, they're very interested in what we're doing on the urban front, because they're increasingly, with massive urbanization like in South Africa, poverty and unemployment is increasingly an urban phenomenon, as it is indeed in Africa, notwithstanding the much larger number of small farmers in Africa than in South Africa proportionately, nonetheless also increasingly. So very interested in what we're doing and across a number of fronts. Okay. The third bullet point there, sorry, I'm talking a bit long, but I'm passionate about these things, and I think there's a lot we can learn from other countries, but also from our own experience. What we've done also, not as effectively as we should, and we'll talk about that just now, but we've also tried to introduce labor intensity. So, you know, in the New Deal, in Roosevelt's period, during the last great global crisis in the United States, which impacted on the United States in the 1930s, the New Deal programs were basically labor-intensive programs in terms of roads and dams and things, building big infrastructure. But there, again, were dedicated programs. What we've tried to introduce is labor intensity and expanded public works participation in infrastructure construction in general. Okay. Moving along. One of the areas where we've been real global innovators, real pioneers, has been applying public employment programs on scale to environmental services. Okay, like working for water, working on fire, working for wetlands, which is also a coastlands project and others. The Working for Water program has possibly saved as much as $400 billion, according to the CSIR. There's some debate as to whether it's quite that amount, but, you know, it's of that order. $400 billion in terms of water saved. It's cleared over 2 million hectares of alien invasive plants and prevented the loss, again, according to, I think, CSIR and other independent research, 71% of grazing would have been lost if there had not been this public employment program removing invasive aliens. Working on fire, just in the budget year of 2007-2008, saved the forestry industry alone 3.7 billion rand in fighting fires, and they were doing it on a budget of 123 billion. Now, what's interesting about some of these figures is that they don't appear in the GDP, okay? You know, we remove iron ore out of Kumba, out of the Northern Cape, as dirt, and that counts billions of rands into our GDP. But it's gone. Once it's out, it's non-renewable. What this is doing is saving, putting back things into, for instance, the environment. But the curious way in which GDP figures are calculated, it doesn't really count. And what we do count is the 123 million we spent, because that features in the GDP figures, on the stipends to the firefighters. But what they say is, for instance, in 1 year, that it doesn't figure. Okay. So you can hear what one's also doing is trying to make a case. These are real jobs. This is real, okay, not to get into a polemic, but this is real work. It's not always, and sometimes it's people digging holes and sitting under trees and so on. We know the examples like that. But where it's working well, it's doing extremely useful and very important things. And as public employment practitioners, which I hope everyone in this committee is, and certainly I know that the colleagues, at least from this program in the department, are, you know, we need to be making the case for the massive contribution that can be made and is already being made. Okay. Moving on, South Africa is also the only country in the world, as far as we know, with a whole range of public employment programs in the social sector, including adult education, early childhood care, school feeding schemes, school safety, homework supervision programs, and so on. During the AIDS denialism period, many colleagues working on this front used the budget of the public employment programs, or EPWP programs, to just ensure that there was home-based care was extended into townships and communities that were suffering from the ravages of this HIV/AIDS thing, so providing some basic services to communities. Okay, and then we've already mentioned that a newish development now, also in these programs, is involving much more actively the non-state sector, community through the community work program, the non-profit organizations of various kinds, and so on. faith-based organizations, community-based organizations, and so on. And these are very important. I mean, first of all, they're working in any case. We know many, many examples of usually women, usually in poor communities, doing things voluntarily. Great crisis advice, home-based care, and so on. Wherever you go, I think all of us in our constituencies know that we're seeing that. And sometimes they get a little bit of overseas funding, sometimes they get some funding from social development, but it's never enough and the needs are massive. The National Development Plan makes this point in Chapter 11. It says that the NGO, non-profit sector in our country, in the social sector, is in crisis. We're no longer the flavor of the global community in terms of funding NGOs and so on. And so we can really use the resources we've got in the public employment program to work with the current of what is happening here. Well, people are doing it in any case. Let's assist them to have a few more volunteers who at least are provided with more than just, you know, with nothing basically. And are just doing it for the love of working for their communities and their people. But it also gives us opportunity to train them and upgrade them a little bit, train them in home-based care, train them in early childhood learning, and so on. And there's some wonderful examples on the ground. So pushing into the space is very important, and working much more closely, not just as a bureaucratic machine running these things, as that, and with apologies to my colleagues who are in the bureaucracy, but also working. It's not to say that all NGOs are angels. We know they're not. Not all community-based organizations are. Have a social conscience, but many do, and working more closely with them. Okay. Then just to provide a kind of, and we want to do more and more of this, because often we're talking just numbers and head counts and so on, and those are important, but we want to try to use the department as the key secretariat for the public employment programs to begin to popularize, to learn lessons, not necessarily from our own DPW experience, but from what's also happening through other line departments and so on. So here's one example. Very nice thing that's been going since 2011 in Gauteng. The education department there identified a number of challenges, which are typical of challenges, particularly in sort of poorer schools, in working class communities and so on. So the kids are not getting support for homework, for all the understandable socioeconomic reasons. There might be child-headed households, or their parents themselves don't have education, or much education, so they don't understand, can't help with homework, or the parents are at work if they're lucky enough to have work and get back late because of lousy public transport and so on. So the whole homework thing, supervision and so on, is fine if you live in a family like mine and most of ours. But for many, many, many households, it's a big problem. We assume that people can do. Lack of safety of schools, which get targeted by drug dealers, computers and things like that get stolen. And also, we know that, again, in former Model C schools, like the ones that my kids went to, wonderful sports facilities and school leagues and so on, but in township schools, there's hardly any creative or sporting activities in afternoons and so on. So a big gap. So they responded in the Gauteng province, the education department there, using an expanded public works, a public employment approach. So they've employed homework and sports supervisors in three different categories for those different grades, and they work half a day, and they've currently got 8,200 supervisors in 911 schools, and then they've also got security and safety personnel working at 1,262 schools on site. Using the EPWP thing. The first bullet point is the one around homework and sports supervisors. It's a wonderful opportunity to provide some work experience to young matriculants, for instance, who are passionate about sport or, you know, have some skills, who maybe are studying part-time at UNISA or something like that, but are short of money. So it's a wonderful thing that works for them nicely. But also provides the desperately needed service that otherwise doesn't want it. So a wonderful innovation. Moving on, I really talked to this already, but this just gives a visual impact. The slides maybe are not so, we've already mentioned the significant amount of savings in terms of water that we've seen through the Working for Water program. That's Leandre Ahrens, because it's so important that we give faces to the participants. She's not just alone, she's holding a Rooikrans wattle invasive plant. I know that because I also do caring of invasives. She does it more professionally than I do. She works at the group. But there are thousands of these participants in Working for Water around the country doing very useful things. And on the right bottom hand, there is really a Working for Water thing, which is not so legible, but I think it speaks for itself. On the left is where we are today. But if we don't care the invasive aliens, they start to take over our river courses. And in 20 to 40 years' time, you can see there's a massive diminishing of the water supply coming through that water course. That's because these invasives are very water hungry. They haven't grown up in South African or Southern African conditions. So we've, you know, many of our indigenous plants, not least here in the Western Cape, in the Fynbos area, are very drought resistant. They've had to be. But if you get an Australian plant or something like the wattle that Leandre Ahrens is holding up, it chows the water. It outgrows all of the other indigenous plants, so they also disappear. So the biodiversity also starts to disappear. Okay, moving on. So those are some of the positive things that we want to talk about, the good story, if you like, about, and the good lessons and positive lessons. But that's not to say that there aren't also lessons. So it's not just about being triumphant. We need to look critically and self-critically and ask ourselves, how to go forward. There are good things and we must build on them, but there are also things which we didn't understand properly or clearly, or that people don't understand clearly. So the first prime point we want to make is that, on that slide, is that there's often a confusion, both in the broad public, but also amongst practitioners ourselves sometimes, as to what we're trying to achieve through a public employment program. And we often then load a whole lot of expectations on a public employment program. So the one is poverty relief. So let's get as many stipends to as many people as possible. And although to us a stipend of which, and the minimum stipend is $67.50 a day, and some are paid a bit more than that, some quite a bit more than that, but it shouldn't be, and occasionally we're picking up it is less. To us, 67 Rand 50 doesn't sound like much, but it's incredible how people compete to get on these programs in poor communities, and even if it's just for 2 months or 3 months, for them it's like a lifesaver. Okay, it just helps a little bit with some problems. So the sustainable household livelihoods is a very, very important component of these public employment programs. It's just to bring, we've got 16 million people now on social grants. There's a debate as to whether it's sustainable or not and so on, but it'd be, again, it's some help. But it doesn't cover millions of people, even that very extensive coverage of social grants. We know that an unemployed person of 26 is not in the child support grant, might not be injured, so there's not a disability grant, falls between the cracks. So as the National Development Plan correctly recognizes, these stipends that travel through the Expanded Public Works and Community Work programs is one way of getting some kind of grant, if you like, some kind of income relief into poor communities and to poor households. So that's one very important objective, outcome that one's trying to achieve through these EPWPs. But the second one on the left is skills development. Very important. Because what happens to this, so they're on for 100 days or 60 days or whatever of a work opportunity, it's some money coming into a household, but what happens to them afterwards? So can we not also try to introduce some kind of skills development into the program? And yes, of course we must, beginning with just the skill to do the particular, even menial task that we ask them to do, but perhaps something more that enables them to graduate, the participants, to graduate into something else. And then thirdly, something that we mustn't ignore, and we sometimes do, and we're not counting and assessing it, although we're trying to do it with Working for Water, working on fiber, we need to do more broadly, it's not just about what happens to the individual participants, but what is the impact on a poor community. There's a project that builds a school or a clinic. How do we measure the impact? Has it really changed the lives of a poor community? Not from day to night or night to day, but what sort of impact has it had? The experience of working together in a community, people burn libraries. We've seen this again. So they're public assets, but they take no responsibility for them. They just see them as some alien thing. It's government that has delivered. We don't like government's delivery. We're just going to express our anger and frustration. So there's no sense of ownership and responsibility for community assets. Can we use the Expanded Public Works program for people to decide what it is that they want? Maybe they don't want the clinic. Maybe the priority is something else, repair the road or whatever. Not just to build a thing, but to maintain it and take responsibility as a community. So the Expanded Public Work programs offer us the opportunity, the possibility, and we see it happening sometimes, but not always, of building greater community cohesion. These are poor communities, they're angry, they're frustrated. Half the township has got RDP houses, the other half hasn't yet got it. There's anger, frustration. The community gets factionalized around that, backyard dwellers versus informal settlement, is who's going to be on the housing queue, all the problems that we know from our constituencies. How do we make people not just the recipients of grants, but also protagonists, active creators of a different kind of community, working together and so on? There are many, many international studies that show that there's nothing more debilitating than unemployment in terms of feeling useless, feeling alienated, never having the experience of working in a team, working together, being productive and so on. The very interesting US studies of this, where they show that, you know, absolute poverty is one thing. Unemployment, where people might not be so absolutely poor, but there's just communities that have been struck with long, you know, decades of unemployment. Those are the communities that become rife with drugs and dysfunctionality and so on. So the experience of collective work, maintaining your thing and so on, is very important. So the provision of assets and services could also be early childhood care and so on. Okay. So all three are very important, and I think that any program that ignores any one of them will be wrong. Any EPW program would need to look at how best can we maximize the impact of all three of those kinds of objectives. But the important thing to understand is you can't do all equally. There's a trade-off between them. You need to do all of them as best as possible to factor all of them in. But emphasis in one direction is going to typically lead you to do less on the other. So let's use an example, and let's move to the next slide. Which sort of makes the point, I think, fairly enough. So on the left is a picture of working on fire participants. These are the firefighters, I think. There are 5,000 of them every year participating, and many of them then last for many years on the program. So we're not pushing people through the program. It requires high levels of skill. There hasn't been a single loss of life in the 10 years on the fire line. They're not fighting building fires. They're fighting self fires, basically. So they have to, in the middle of the night, have to climb up into dangerous mountainous territory and so on into fighting fires. They have to be very fit. So they train every single day. Apparently, week. I don't know if it's weekends as well. I think there might be. So you can see there's a strong sense of team. They're very well trained. They have to be, because you can't expose these young people into very dangerous situations. And because they're well trained, there are excellent possibilities of graduating from being a firefighter like the ones you're seeing in front. By the way, also lovely figure, 32% of them are women, are young women. That's the highest anywhere in the world in terms of women in this quite physically demanding task. And they're brilliant performers by all accounts, the women in the program, as are the young men as well. I don't know if any colleagues have come across these brigades, basically, of working on fire. You can just see there's a sense of pride and morale and it's a little bit military, okay? But you can see there's something wonderful has happened to these youngsters who are otherwise unemployed. It's, touches the heart, you know, to see young South Africans born into poverty with a sense of pride and dignity and wearing their uniforms and so on, and knowing that they're providing a massive service. When there were those terrible fires in Franschhoek here in the Western Cape 2 years ago, you remember that, 90% of the firefighters were working on fire participants. Many of them flown in from Limpopo and Mpumalanga and so on, so they were flown in to fight the fire, and, you know, without that, that resource would not have succeeded in putting out a devastating fire. Okay. So they graduate, many of them graduate because it's working on fire is 5,000 participants, and we think with more budget they can start about 17,000. There's a national need for about 17,000 of those firefighters. Many of them graduate up into, there's also an administrative and training capacity, so many of them graduate into that. They become dispatchers, they become trainers, and so on. Many of them also then, some of them graduate into the police service and so on because of their discipline and skills and so on. Others go into regular, you know, municipal firefighting. The one I've met from my old constituency here now is the mechanic on the helicopter at the firefighting station at Newlands. If you go along the M3 to Musenberg up there in the Newlands Forest, there's a firefighting helicopter, which is also a working on fire helicopter. And this is a graduate of Abina. It comes from the Santa Croix township, and is now, he says he wants to become a helicopter pilot. I don't know if that's a bridge too far, but you can see this is someone whose life has been turned around. He's very proud and pleased of what he's doing. Okay, by contrast on the right, and I didn't mean to insult it because it's a bit of, it's the community work program. Okay. And those are people basically cleaning up. You know, if you go into all of our townships, it's just rubbish lying everywhere. There's not effective municipal services and so on. That's work. It's very useful work. It's not the only work that a community work program can do, but it's one of the work. So what they're doing is cleaning up this just like mess in the township. And they're earning a stipend, and they get some basic training and so forth. And the great thing about the community work program is it can be scaled up massively, very quickly, because it's not firefighting and fire training, and it's the community itself deciding what are the priorities. So they meet in community halls, facilitated by non-profit organizations, and they decide, right, what we're going to do for the next 2 months is build a fruit garden over here and set it up. Over there we're going to clean up this empty stretch of felt or whatever. So they select the work that they want to do. And I think the target is 2,000 or 3,000 participants per ward. Is it 1,000 participants? Okay, so you can scale it up very quickly, and we're very excited about that. But so working on fire, given the level of training and equipment and fitness levels and so on that are required, you can't achieve large numbers. So it's currently 5,000 across the country nationally, and hopefully we can push it up in phase three to perhaps approaching 17,000 if we get the budget and if we make the argument correctly. So you can see there the emphasis on training and the ability to graduate and so forth. On the community work program, it's much more about reaching the maximum number of people and impacting on providing some kind of basic services and assets into poor communities. So it's wrong to say the one is the right one and the other one is the wrong one. I think that's what we're trying to say. We're trying to say that don't try to do everything equally because you'll fail. Understand what a particular project works best for and maximize the impact it makes in terms of its particular strength and limitations. And so that's a message. So I think it's clear what one's trying to say. That, and both are wonderful programs. Both can be messed up, of course, but both are potentially really wonderful programs, but with different strengths. Okay. Lesson number two. Really sort of made the point, but just making it in a different form. You see, what happens with politicians and in Parliament and so on is that we all focus on the number, the target. 4.5 million work opportunities, 6 million going into things. And it's right, because those targets are important. particularly in a country with massive unemployment and all of the challenges we've got. So we need to stretch ourselves and be ambitious but realistic about the targets we're setting ourselves. But the danger is, particularly when you're dealing with Treasury, not to help Treasury, but is that it's number crunching. And so some of the other issues can get lost. And so certainly from DPW going into phasing, we are determined to say, yeah, 6 million, we're committed to that. We're going to work hard, and we think we might even surpass it if we do our work effectively, and we could. But let's not neglect the other important things. Otherwise, we'll just be counting heads, but we won't be asking how long were they participating. Because if you're just pushing numbers, then you're incentivizing municipalities just to push numbers, regardless of the work, I use municipalities, that applies to all of us, what assets or services are actually provided. What happened to the participants after they participated? Did they benefit from it? Not just because for 3 months they earned a stipend, but did they acquire some skills and so on? So we are the data capturers as DPW, so this is a little bit self-critical, but trying to all of us to understand it. It's under the pressure of numbers. So what we're saying as politicians to our colleagues in the department, we are the data capturers across the programs. And we must capture the data, we must do the head count, the work opportunities, also the full-time equivalents, which we try to do. But we must be more ambitious and also try to measure the quality impact in terms of what happens to participants. How do we begin to measure the assets or services provided and so on, which is why I've been talking about that when we talk about working for water and so on. What is the impact on a community and so on. Now, that's complicated, okay? It's one thing just counting heads and ticking them off, and it's another trying to measure the qualitative impact. And so we won't necessarily be able to do it across every project and everything and every participant. But we need to do pilot studies, we need to do a range of things and find ways of beginning to, because it will also make the case for better budgeting, for more effective performance and so on. Okay. The problem on lesson number 3 is that on the infrastructure front, infrastructure is the largest contributor to work opportunities. And certainly in our projections going forward, it will remain that. Okay. But the problem with infrastructure construction, underlying construction, is that you construct something and you have EPWP and other workers on the job, but the footbridge is completed or the clinic or the whatever early childhood learning center is completed, and then the job's over. And the participants come to an end, and maybe they've been there for 30 days or 40 days, or the average is 65 days, and then it's over. And so what we're saying is that infrastructure is critically important, but let, for the public employment programs, focus on construction, but much, much, much more on maintenance of infrastructure, which in any case is a crisis in our country. We all know that. Politicians, you've heard me say this before, politicians love cutting the ribbon on the new building, on the new road, you know, whether we're national politicians or municipal politicians, and so we love that, but we're not so interested in maintaining the rural road or looking after the water pump or the sanitation facility and so on. And yet maintenance is local, it needs to be ongoing, and lots of it requires supervision, obviously, but a lot of it is appropriate for low-skilled and labor-intensive approaches. We look at our own buildings as public works. You can tell a public building from a private building, typically, I'm afraid to say, because it's not being looked after. The grass outside is in sham, not being, and you know, that's work. It's public employment work. So even getting the coordination between ourselves as the Department of Public Works, EPWP program, and some of our other programs, we're not coordinating effectively, DG. We know that. We've been saying that self-critically, and we're beginning to, on security of our buildings, on maintenance and so on. So a big emphasis on, so interestingly, 65 days is the average infrastructure work opportunity. But when you move to maintenance, on the road maintenance programs like the Mbele and so on, it's 108 days. So that tells you that, you know, it's obvious that maintenance is so. But when it comes to infrastructure, there's another big challenge. And that is we're battling with the built environment professions. You know, let me be a bit brutal, okay, so it's a bit more nuanced than I'm saying it, but they train engineers, let's say, as if we were living in the United Kingdom or France or whatever, and not appropriate to the realities of South Africa. They're trained in countries where they used to be, they're not anymore, relatively full employment, where the profile of workers is more skilled than our profile, given our whole apartheid history and so forth. So we need engineers, we need architects, we need built environment professions that understand the developmental challenges of our country. And one of those is the high levels of unemployment, and therefore we need to be using suitable, appropriate, I don't mean inappropriate, labor-intensive approaches to building roads, to maintaining roads, to looking after buildings, to building buildings, and so forth. And we encounter resistance from the professionals. Not from all, and many recognizers and so on, from the training institutes, and are really picking up the ball in this front and so on. So that is something that we really have to do. And we need to then also into our contracts as the public sector, whether it's public works or other public sector bonds, build in tough requirements in terms of labor intensity for maintenance, for construction and so on of infrastructure, and punish them, not just for collusion, they collude, but for not implementing effective labor intensity. So that's something that in phase three we've really got to pay much more attention to. Another lesson we've learned is that there's sometimes resistance and reluctance to take on enthusiastic public employment programs from public bodies. There are several factors. The one is the one I've almost touched upon, more or less sort of touched upon in a slightly different context. There's a feeling that if we go for labor-intensive approaches as this municipality when we build this particular clinic, we're going to get something that is of poor quality and so on. That's true if it's labor-intensive and inappropriately done, if it's labor-intensive and not properly supervised, and so on. But it's not true. And globally, there are many international studies showing that, you know, in China, they use labor-intensive methods. They're building things faster than anybody else in the world, and we have to import them to come and fix our lifts in Parliament and so forth. We need to build and maintain according to our strengths. But there's a resistance, and it's something that both in the professional sector but also in the public sector as well. The problems around compliance challenges. So when we say to a municipality, why aren't you using an expanded public works program? They say, yes, but it's very complicated and so on. And there are some problems. I think we're conceding that as the Department of Public Works. We've got two different reporting systems, as I understand. It's not our fault necessarily. There's some prefer the one and others prefer the other. But we've got to clean up the reporting thing. So there's too much red tape sometimes and too much effort in that. And we need to also reach out much more. So we've got 100 data captures in Pretoria behind computer screens, basically. But we're not perhaps enough. I know Kelly Bokwe and the colleagues here do spend a lot of time going out into projects and so on. But we need to be more proactive as a department. And then there's the big issue. municipalities, they have a public employment program which runs for a year, and then they run into a problem because all the participants expect, okay, now you need to employ us full-time on your books. And so having experienced that once, they're then reluctant to repeat it a second and third because they run into all kinds of problems of protests and so on. So we've got to sort that out. We've got to more carefully explain to participants what the project is. Some projects certainly can make place for interesting progression out of EPWP into something else. Others might be less so. A community work program typically might not offer that, but will still do some useful and important things. So to be much clearer about what we're trying to achieve. Lovely examples. In Tembisa, for instance, Eskom, and a part of Tembisa, Eskom installed through contractors a lot of solar panels, you know, solar geyser heaters. Many of them were not well installed, and all kinds of problems. And so then the Ekurhuleni Metro then developed, how many, Tanda, was it? How many participants? I think it's like 200, 500? 200 participants in a section of the township. Employed them as EPWP. They trained them to fix and maintain the solar water geyser heaters. And they're now busy in the second phase, so they're now going to become co-ops, 5 by 5 by 5. So that's what, 40 co-ops to work in this area of maintaining and servicing geysers. And they will be on the preferred list of providers to the municipality. Now, obviously, they can't go on doing that because then they'll have too many co-ops. So it's also a way of being intelligent about what you're doing and have a program for graduation where that's possible. So, okay. Although it might be possible to multiply it, of course, as we roll out more and more, because we're committed to a million solar panels over the next period. Okay. Big problem. Okay. Lesson 5. The accusations, and maybe some of them are wrong, but in some cases I think they're right, that the way in which participants get selected is done in corrupt ways, basically, for patronage purposes. So you are, we all like, we're national politicians, so we blame councillors, it's easy to do that. So you're the local ward councillor, and there's money for an EPWP project, and you select your uncle, auntie, three cousins, and the supporters in your DA branch, or your ANC branch. It happens in both cases. We'll put you on the program because you're going to support us at the next election or whatever when it comes to this. That's happening. Okay. And when that happens, it's a disaster for what we're trying to achieve. I mean, it's wrong, first, in a form of corruption. But instead of building community cohesion, people say, and I've heard it from in regard to both ANC and DA, by the way, maybe both allegations are wrong, but you've got to show your card, your membership card, before you'll be on the program or not. It's happening. We know that. We know it's happening. Maybe it gets exaggerated by people who are disappointed that they aren't on the program or something, but it's happening. Okay. It means that instead of building a community cohesion and a sense of ownership of the project or the assets they provide, you're dividing the community and politicizing it, and not even politicizing it. You're just turning it into members of members, you know, as we say in the ANC, kind of some. And then when that ward council gets thrown out for corruption or whatever, the new one comes in, and all those participants get thrown off the program, and a new set of cousins, aunties, and uncles get put on it. It's a huge, it's a big problem, okay, and we've really got to do it. So one of the ways in which we're doing it is through the non-profit organization and community. They're not necessarily angels either, community-based organizations, but at least it helps to depoliticize. I mean, politicize in a narrow sense, you know, party political or even narrow personal ambition way. Okay. So here's a nice example, and just to show that I'm not being electoralist, it comes from the Western Cape Department of Transport and Public Works, okay? Because this thing is kind of, regardless of what the election outcomes are, so we've got to work together. And I'm very pleased, by the way, let me say, that after a little bit of a wobble from the DA around real jobs and what are real jobs and so on, we're seeing a firm commitment from the DA also. We're all agreeing that ideally we need people in formal employment, but we've got millions and millions of people in that. And this is not the total silver bullet, but a very important intervention, development. And we're getting cross-party support for that, and I'm very anxious that we hold on to that. So, Anja. Sorry? Now, he knows that, and in fact, I've been working with him on this, and I asked him to give us that. So how in the Western Cape, and I could have chosen an ANC province or something, but I'm deliberately not, because I'm trying to make this point. Okay. So when they're busy with a infrastructure construction program, okay, so it could be building a clinic, let's say, in a municipality, what's the provincial department does, working with the municipality, the provincial public works department with the municipality, says, first of all, you've got to establish a community forum. Now, in many townships, there are community forums, but in others, there aren't. And if there isn't, it must be established. If there's an existing one, then you don't displace it, obviously. And that forum must be made up of the local NGOs, religious leaders, faith-based leaders, business associations, relevant government authorities that are working in that space, and the community liaison officer. Okay. And the responsibility of the forum is to create an awareness about the project, it's the clinic, let's say, that they're going to build, and the opportunities that will flow from it. So in other words, yeah, so the people in the township, not your followers, but the people in the township as widely as possible, are aware that a clinic is going to be built, and it's going to, the X number of public employment, EPWP possibilities in the project, but also, you know, artisans and some. So also formal sector jobs might be, local jobs might be required. The contractor, because typically we don't build the thing ourselves, we contract, we tender the contract for the actual contract, the contractor that builds the clinic, is forced in the contract signed, in the tender and then the contract signed, to establish a project steering committee. That's the, which involves the contractor, the implementing agent, which would be perhaps the municipality, the client department, might be a provincial health department, representatives nominated from the community forums, local religious leaders perhaps, local business people and so on. And they're required to employ a specified quota of EPWP jobs and other local labor. And one of the functions then of the project steering committee is to facilitate the recruitment of the labor. So they do it, it's not the ward council. Okay. So then, I'm going on, it's the same process. In the contract with the contractor, the following are mandatory. There has to be a well-advertised public meeting or meetings, depending on the size of the township and the project. The nature of the opportunities have to be explained. Job application forms are handed out to those who come to the meeting, and they're assisted with filling in the form. And then all the forms are put into a sealed box. It's like IEC style stuff. Okay. And then the steering committee, in full view of the meeting, not in some secret place, pulls out. So let's say they're looking for 50 public employment participants. They will take out 50, it's like a lottery number, 50, and then they will announce and people will know who they are, and then they'll take out a further 50 because they often drop out and one, so that's like a reserve list. Okay. And then they keep also, all those who applied, they keep also as a database for, you know, to inform us on. So the attempt is to make the community participants and owners so that they own the result of the selection process as much as possible. There will be disappointed people because they didn't get the job, but at least they can't say that they didn't have a chance and that it was done behind the scenes and so on. So it's a lovely, lovely approach and an important approach. It's not necessarily workable in every case and so on. It's one form. The community work program, similar thing, but it's more the community even deciding what the work is to be done and so forth. So the variations of this. In other places, municipalities will use their, or province will use their indigenous list, what you call an indigenous list that they've got and so on. Obviously, the more transparent you can make it, the more community participation, the better in general. Okay. The Indians do this, by the way, as well, in similar ways. They underline to us transparency, the more transparency you make, what's happening, you know, this is a project. You put up at the project site in the township, this is the project. These are the number of people working. These are the number of local people that are involved. These are even the list of local people. So someone can say, hang on, but this person actually, you know, they're doubling up the course or whatever. You know, make the local community the monitors and evaluations and not just the Department of Public Works data captures. They have an important role to play. But the more, that's participatory democracy. Socialism, by the way, that's, I won't push my luck too far in this particular meeting. Okay. And then lesson six, okay, the need for much greater coordination. I've said that unlike the amazing Indian program, in South Africa, with the scale, the diversity, and innovative nature of things, we've got quite a complex program going. And as a result of that, the very strength of this diversity is also a bit of a problem. So when right at the beginning I said, look, we're not advertising what we're not telling the good story, when there is a good story. Part of that is just because it's in dozens of different line departments, so there's not a common branding. Even the word expanded public work program, a lot of people say, that does the community work program fit into it? So we need to maybe find a different word for the program, different branding. Masakani is a bit overdone, but something like that. You know, let's pull together this word together, or something like that. Also, it's in Guni language there too. We need to find. But we need to brand it, okay, better. We need to be able to communicate as government, regardless of the political party that we're from, about these programs, so that we're also working together. Okay. We need to share lessons across programs. Wonderful things happening and working on fire. Not necessarily, you know, learned in some other program. So we try that. We have our summits and things like that. We try to share lessons and some of not enough, and it's DPW that's trying to do it. And because we're just another line department, often there might be enthusiasm from our colleagues in working for water, but not necessarily from a DG or from a minister in that line department. So we work as public employment practitioners, but there are line departments and provinces and municipality divisions that sometimes get in the way of effective coordination and learning lessons. Okay. And then the last bullet point there, it's not just public employment, we need also to be coordinating much better. You see now, government is doing lots of things around SME development, not enough, not good enough, whatever, but fine on that front. The same with cooperative development. On the higher education side, there are all kinds of initiatives around training, adult training and so forth, post-school training and so forth. On the social development side, there are various food security programs and so on, sustainable livelihoods and so on. But we're not coordinating properly at all often the interface between a public employment program and cooperative development being run by a DTI agency. Or between a CETA providing training and the training that could be so useful into a public employment process. Okay, that's not us. So last point there, and we'll come back to it a little bit, is that it's for this reason that the November cabinet meeting, as a result of a cabinet, we're proud to say, introduced by the Department of Public Works, has agreed that what we need actually is a presidential coordinating commission, a bit along the lines, obviously quite different as well, to the infrastructure coordinating commission, so that you give it a presidential override, because DPW has an important role to play in this, and that's acknowledged by the cabinet decision. But you need to elevate these programs to a much more all-encompassing, not house them or try and house them in a single line department, which then tries to coordinate other equal national line departments. You need to use presidential authority, basically, to be able to have an effective coordination. Okay. This is an example of what we're doing in the department in terms of enterprise and cooperative development. So we have a particular program within our EPWP program. To basically inject an enterprise or cooperative development element into it. So there are programs that we support, like Working for Water and others on the left-hand side there, where we come in and assist a program that they do, and we assist them with an enterprise development element in it. There are programs that that are internal to the National Department of Public Works, like the National Youth Service Program and so forth. And we also program drivers around co-ops. So let me give an example. Would it be nice to illustrate it? But one example that I recently visited was in Mangung, where the metro is doing road maintenance, basically, in some of the townships. Which department? Is it a provincial department that is basically running, or metro, but with the provincial department of roads, probably, or whatever. And what we've done through Vukatile, as a department, is we've assisted grade one and two start-up engineering construction companies, little companies, in the area. So we've connected them. So they are basically running the road maintenance, and the participants in the maintenance are being funded out of an expanded public works program participation process. We then assist. So it's mutually beneficial. And it was lovely to see. They looked like they were mostly women who were running these little companies. They looked as though they were about 28, but I'm getting old, so they were probably about 35. And again, just lovely to see a sense of both from the participants, but also the new little enterprise. And they were saying this is fantastic because otherwise, you know, we're getting work, and we've now got the chance of also moving up our grades and so forth, because you can only do that once you've got some experience. So it's a very nice program. Okay, good. Sorry, this is taking long. Sorry, Chairperson, but you can see this is 5 years of phase three, and 10 years plus of experience and lessons to be learned. Okay. So we're trying to jam a lot into. The phase three, what is the context? First of all, the National Development Plan, calls for a very significant expansion of the Expanded Public Works Program, and underlines two key strategic objectives. One in Chapter 3, which is the Employment and Economics chapter of the National Development Plan, and it calls on the public employment programs to target the creation of 2 million work opportunities annually by 2020 or earlier if possible. That's a big scale-up, 2 million per year. So that would mean if we were on 2 million now, our target would be 10 million over the 5-year period. And in particular flags, and if you read the budget very carefully, you'll see that the Treasury is also of like mind, particularly seeing the possibilities for significant upscaling in the community work program. Okay. Doesn't fall under DPW. We support it very firmly. We agree that it has huge scaling up possibilities. And then Chapter 11, which is the social security chapter of the National Development Plan, understands the connection between these initiatives and other social protection measures as well, correctly so. The New Growth Path also talks about expanded public employment programs, and we mentioned those there under that bullet point. Okay, this slide is really just a pictorial diagrammatic representation, I suppose, what I've been talking about. But just to remind, since I've been talking so long, maybe I've forgotten what I was saying. The key paradigm shifts that we've been making through as we now move into phase three. So phase one, the expanded public works, was basically designed to bridge a so-called gap between a so-called first and second economy. We also think that too many expectations were created for the program, such as maximizing the spread and skilling all beneficiaries to be exited into the mainstream economy. So it was good, we put public employment programs onto the map, but the expectations that we placed onto phase one turned out to be not a problem in terms of the numbers participating, but the assumptions about graduation into formal employment and so on, all of those proved to be not understanding the context in which we are operating. Okay. Phase two, the course in phase one, although there was growth, 1 million formal sector jobs were lost, the unemployment problem actually got worse, we realized that the problem we're dealing with wasn't just temporary. There's a little bit of an apartheid legacy, there's a second economy, but as the first economy grows, that problem will disappear and we'll be able to just for time, for 5 years or whatever, we need to do a little bit of testing. and a bit of Hispanic Public Works program. We realized in phase two that we're dealing with a structural, systemic problem, and we needed to contribute through the public employment programs and a number of other initiatives to changing that. And therefore, we needed to integrate what we were doing on the public employment programs with a wider approach. Phase three now, the paradigm shifts that we're trying to make, is much greater coordination across all of the public employment programs and between public employment programs and other developmental initiatives like training, SMME development, co-op development, and so on. Better monitoring and evaluation of what happens after participation to the participants, and also on the impact of services and assets created. I'm talking about poor communities, but obviously working for water, obviously there's an impact on mainstream agriculture, for instance. And also increase the maintenance side of things on infrastructure. So those are some of the key sort of shifts that we think are absolutely critical to building on the successes, but also learning lessons from the past. Okay, so just on the training and graduation side, we want to say that project-based training aimed at capacitating EPWP participants remains an important part of EPWP. So even if it's a very low-skilled activity in a community work program, removing rubble and things like that from a field and so on, you still need to train people to work as a team, to practice basic safety precautions, to have proper protective gear, and so forth. So the training, even if it's pretty elementary, is important, and can offer people some basic skills and just the experience for the first time ever in their lives of doing some work in a team, which is often the case, I'm afraid to say. But at the same time, a point I've been making a lot, the training will vary considerably according to the sector, the particular sub-program, and so on. And therefore, each sector will have to develop its own appropriate training policy and strategy. We need to build a much stronger collaboration between the National Skills Fund and what we're doing, and also between the various CETAs. There's also interesting things coming out of the Department of Higher Education. They're talking about now setting up community colleges, particularly in poor communities. There are existing networks of adult basic education trainers and little facilities and NGOs, and basically we've won that battle, believe it or not, of adult illiteracy. Not completely, but basically, but there's a lot of experience in terms of adult education around, and we need to work closely with it, and that's the plan in the Department of Higher Education, to have evening classes and things like that, things that can work nicely with localized public employment programs. And then, as I keep saying, you also need to connect much better with other initiatives around cooperatives and small enterprise development. To turn, because this is an issue that has come up, I think, from the Portfolio Committee, so we thought we should talk a little bit about it, which is the National Youth Service. This is our own in-house training program, basically focused on artisanal training. And because it's artisanal training, the numbers are never going to be massive. Okay? Not from within. Obviously, an ESCOM or a Transnet can do much larger artisanal training, and they're all beginning to do it. But we're not happy, and I know the committee has not been happy, that we haven't reached our target of about 3,500 was the target of participants, and I think we were 800-900. Okay. So the criticism is accepted and noted, particularly as a Department of Public Works, because we are doing public works, and there are things that require artisans, and we don't have artisans, and it's in our own interest to develop and train artisans. And essentially what we're saying is that the weakness there has been an internal weakness, a failure to connect effectively between the National Youth Service, which is run out of our EPWP division program, and our projects. And it's part of the problems And it's a big problem that we've got in the Department of Public Works, lack of, so it's not just a problem of coordination between different line departments and businesses, even in DPW, DG. We're not linking the National Youth Service thing with our construction projects, for instance, significantly. So that's been the limitation. So the funding is there. We haven't been able to find the projects. So we're saying that as a lesson and self-critically, and it's been the Sport Radio Committee that has pointed that out to us. If we didn't know, thank you for doing it. We need to know. Okay. The next slide just describes how we approach it. So it involves initiation, a pre-implementation phase, a recruitment, induction training, technical training, the tender process, and so on. And then an exit workshop. Okay, and then that next slide is also just informing you on how I think the third bullet point is an official in the department saying, look, if we need to be covered budget-wise, and if we don't, the promises we're hoping to make can't be fulfilled. And then the next slide just talks about the targets that we're setting. So you can see from the 800, 900 that we've got, we're wanting to be more ambitious in terms of our national beneficiaries, 3,600 this year. And then you see the other provincial and artisanal development figures and targets going through to 2018 and 19. Okay. But DG, somewhere we must be better. And if we're talking the message of coordination across government, we must also set an example in that respect. Okay, I think I've made this point on slide 3, but maybe just that first sub-bullet point, creating synergies. One of the issues that's coming up, we encounter tensions. So the colleagues, the senior officials working for water, get irritated with the community work program. Because they're also going out and removing invasive alien plants, but they don't know how to do it, and so they make a bigger mess, and actually the problem is greater than before, so they shouldn't do it. Now, you can't tell a community that says, look, in my constituency, there was some there was some rapes of young girls on the Cape. That's in my constituency. And the community decided they were going to go. And it was happening in some empty felt where there were a lot of wattles, invasive wattles. And so the community decided after the third one had happened that they were going to themselves go out and get rid of the invasives. And the Working for Water people said, no, but look, this is not a strategic area. It's not in a water course and so on. And so you've got a silly standard. So what we're saying is, the community is not doing it to save water, they're doing it for some other reason and other priority. Let the Working for Water teams come in and train the community workers so they do it properly, and so on. So it's to get those connections. But when you're working across line departments and so forth, it's sometimes hard to or different spheres of government. So we need to really help the coordination bit. Okay. These are the employment targets. Basically amounting to 6,000 work opportunities. These are the work opportunity targets for phase 3. You can see, say, 6 million. What did I say? 6,000. Would be easier to 6,000. 6 million. And you can see the spread. These are provisional. The 6 million is not provisional. We must hit it, and we will. But according, depending on how different programs develop, and even in the light of the current budget allocations, the community work program, for instance, is likely to increase its numbers and targets. So we won't decrease the others and make up the 6 million. But if we can scale up there, and certainly from Treasury and certainly from our side, there's a commitment to a significant scaling up on the CWP. But those are, and a lot depends on budget allocations and so on, according to, and performance. So if we see that one is doing better and there's scope for them, then we'll adjust, obviously, in the future years. The next slide, really, I think just, it's again, preaching now to, I'm sure the converted, if you weren't converted before, but really just makes the range of things that we're trying to achieve now in order to ensure much greater impact. This is not just make work for the sake, keeping people occupied, otherwise they cause trouble, and so on. It's a serious developmental intervention and requires the coordination across all of those things. I'm getting near an end. What are the institutional arrangements? I've already hinted at those. Okay, so the November Cabinet said that we need a presidential and public employment coordinating commission. In a sense, we had the green light to go ahead immediately after November, but we decided that that given that we're about to have elections and so on, let's prepare the ground for that, but let's wait for the incoming administration to actually set it up and consolidate it, rather than set it up and then have different personalities in different places and so on, and have to start again. Like the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, this Public Employment Coordinating Commission would be chaired either by the President or the Deputy President. It should meet quarterly. So it's not like a hands-on thing, but it's an authority, if you like, which should meet quarterly, composed of relevant ministers, the nine premiers, underline nine, not eight, nine premiers, as with the PICC, and the Western Cape Premier makes a very important contribution to the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, and although there'll be an anti-government in the Western Cape, maybe, but a DA government, South Kenya, if we're to believe some, it doesn't matter. We need government, okay, regardless of political party, and therefore the premiers and SALGA. It should be supported by a political management committee and relevant ministers, a political secretariat of relevant ministers and deputy ministers, and it should have two major work streams, public employment programs and employment, and public employment and sustainable livelihoods. Okay, so talking to the two key things. So we're trying to contribute to the unemployment, overcome the employment thing, but often people might not make it into a job as a result of intervention. But if households are more sustainable, if the community is more sustainable, that's a terrific outcome as well, important as well. And the Cabinet acknowledged an important ongoing role for DPW. So we're not surrendering our role. We're improving the chances of us fulfilling the role that we've been playing of technically facilitating the coordination of these programs. But we will now have presidential authority, as it were, to assist us in doing that, rather than relying on DG Public Works Council to DG Environment or whatever, getting good cooperation to us in that case, but not necessarily always. Okay. So we will constitute the technical secretary. Okay. Last slide. Hallelujah. Okay. We'll enhance coordination across the range of PPs and between PPs and other development initiatives. It will foster compliance with core universal principles. I've not talked about that enough, but it's important. We're not picking up an adherence to the minimum wage and employment conditions. There are cases where participants are not getting paid at least the minimum stipend. That's problematic. It's hugely problematic. Or the employment conditions. I mean, we really got to enforce that. We need to ensure that the way in which workers, participants are selected is fair and free, and we overcome the problems of patronage and clientelism and so forth. Okay. There's not necessarily a single approach, but it's very important that that happens. The work provides or enhances public goods and community services. It's not just make work, digging a hole, filling it up again. And we need to push into the space of labor intensity appropriate to the sector and the particular project. Increased community participation so that we're building a sense of ownership and involvement of communities. Maintenance, that point I've made, and much, much more emphasis on monitoring and evaluation of assets created and their impact on communities and the beneficiaries after participation. And that DG is going to involve us gearing up in DPW. We're not alone in doing this, but we've got to, you know, our comfort zone, and it's not so comfortable, our comfort zone is counting heads, and we've got to really step up so that we what we're doing is doing qualitative impact. And then the very last point one wants to make is that this, I'm sure you'll all be returned to Parliament, I hope you'll all be in Public Works Portfolio Committee. This monitoring and evaluation is not just a departmental or a governmental thing. Parliament is really, and you have already helped us as a committee, pointing out shortcomings and problems that you're encountering and so on. So it's to really rise to the opportunities and prospects of Phase 3 and what we can do with our really interesting but uneven public employment programs. We really hope we have a... you'll be a minister, so why am I saying this? You're going to be a, you'll be a minister of public works, but but let's hope this team that we've got, and I'll be a backbencher and I'll be happy to do that, but I hope I'll be in public works, but I hope that really Parliament is going to be very important as well, because it's also about not just getting reports about targets and headcounts, but actually going out and seeing what's happening and learning from what's happening and helping each other to learn and correct. So I just wanted to end on, even though it might be academic, because we're going into elections, we don't know where any of us are going to be, but part of the legacy report is going to be the next incoming portfolio committee has a really important role to play in assisting us, doing something wonderful as South Africans, regardless of how we vote or what political party we vote. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Minister, thank you very much for the presentation. We are passionate about it.
Yes.
You can see it's in you, it's in your blood.
Yes.
And I really think even on Jabi, where he's sitting, he now understands EPW better than, you know, before. Is that it, Rahmi? Yeah. And let me, before allowing members, Sunday I went to a place called Bergersdorp in Lepopo, in Sanin. Not just to add on what you're saying, there were young women moving from house to house, creating awareness on HIV and AIDS. In my culture, they talk about, when they talk about shingles, they talk about the belt of sores. Yeah.
Shingles,
yes. You know, I was so shocked. They're not educated, but they were talking the right stuff. You know, to me, it said a lot. Those who have got ears and eyes to see, they will see what's happening on the ground. It's really happening. In some schools, there's physical education that is taking place in some schools. There are young guys who go to school. They are given 30 minutes to train each and every class. They go out in the soccer field to do that. And we really appreciate that. They're feeding skills. They now eat rice, you know, vegetables, and they don't go hungry. And we really appreciate that, members. We must say it. Not bring in politics, but you must appreciate what's happening on the ground. Those who have got ears and eyes to see, they see it. But those who have got, don't have ears, only have political ears and eyes, won't see it. Thank you very much. Honorable Treya, Mwenye Mabira, Baba Magubane, Uomjapi, Mama Mashan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and I also want to thank the Deputy Minister. I enjoyed listening to him, and it's very clear from the way he presented that he feels very strongly about it. It's passion. It's a joy to listen to somebody who speaks from his heart. Some of the things that I've noted for my, that I want to highlight or want to touch on is actually already mentioned, but maybe I just want to underline it and draw further attention to that. So I've got a few points to make. The first one was... you know, it's wonderful to see that what a public, let's talk about the PEPs, since that's going to be the new name, the public employment programs, can do to alleviate poverty. But we must just keep in mind that it's not the solution, the solve or the silver bullet, I think you used those words, and that there are problems, structural problems in the formal economy. And so the PEPs is almost like a band-aid, but we've got to look at the deeper underlying problem, and that's the formal economy, and we've got to address that. So I just wanted to highlight that. It's not the Economic Development Committee here, so I'm not going to talk about the economic problems. And so it's not the single solution. It's not public. It's an add-on. The other one, I have to give you this example. It's a favorite example in my community that addresses this or illustrates this problem very well. This is Mr. Kim Pratty. You will all know about Pratty Glues, and he's actually in Krugersdorp, which is his factory. And it's a family-owned business, and we've once formed a TA branch in a rural area outside Krugersdorp, Tarleton area. And it was mostly, that branch consisted mostly of young black youths. There was one guy, Abel. And afterwards I said to Abel, Abel, what are your three main wishes? And he said to me, number one, a job, number two, a job, number three, a job. This job, that's, if only he could find a job. And he spoke with such passion, and I really kind of thought, how can I find this album? So I went to see Mr. Pratty. And he said to me, no problem. I will employ Orwell and 10 of his friends tomorrow. Orwell can come and he can bring 10 of his friends, if that was the condition. If we can negotiate the conditions of employment between myself and Orwell and his 10 friends. And until such time, he won't employ more people. He's not expanding his business, although he can and he would like to do that, but until such time as he can negotiate the conditions of employment, he won't do that. So that is just something I want to leave with you, and that touches on the formal economy that we have to address. The patronage and politicizing the programs where you actually hand out or allocate jobs to members of the community. I wanted to make the point about it must be transparent and non-political, and you actually then went on the very next page, the very next, so you talked about the transparency and the objective way in front of the whole community. So I want to underline that is very important, because that is often a very big problem when the process is politicized and communities are divided. The next one I wanted to touch on was page 22, the Presidential Coordinating Commission. It's interesting new development. I immediately, maybe you've answered in your last slide, but my question that I'm noticing myself here, how are we going to do oversight over this body if it's a presidential committee? Because there's not a portfolio committee that does oversight of the president or the president's projects. So I hope this is not going to remove it out of parliamentary oversight. In the last page you said that parliamentary oversight is very important. Will this still stay within public works, or is it moved away from public works into the presidential as a presidential oversight project, and how will we do oversight over that one? The last one I want to make a comment or question. Oh yes, the National Youth Service. It's very important that we do involve the youth and part of that project, but the National Youth Service has become very politicized. And as you underscored the point of, making the allocation in a transparent way so that everybody can see it's fair, I think the same applies even more to the National Youth Service. There's a lot of distrust against the National Youth Service, and I think from where I sit, it's because of politicization. If we can do this in a transparent and a non-partial manner, that would help a lot. I wanted to make one last comment on the branding, and also that also actually deals with politicization. You talked about a common branding for PEPs, public employment projects. That's great, but we've seen there were a couple of instances, say local government or provincial government has started a project, it's very successful, and then another level of government comes in and claims success for it for electioneering purposes. That creates huge problems, and then I think people will be less inclined or less enthusiastic about starting projects if it's going to be hijacked by other levels of government or other spheres of government, I should rather say, for political purposes. So if we have a common branding, regardless of the sphere of government that implements it or the political party that controls that government or that leads that government, we should stick to a generic term and not politicize that as well. Otherwise, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Etoya. It's my turn now to ask a question. Thank you. First of all, I think I need to echo my colleagues' words on thanking the Deputy Minister on this one. Thank you very much. Really, it leaves us more excited than before. But I've got a few clarity-seeking questions. For instance, although some of the questions I wanted to ask you, they were clarified towards the end of the presentation. For instance, regarding the big private companies, I think we've been having very serious problems with them. On this EPWP, they will tell you that they were using, first of all, they were using very big machines to say it's going to slow down the process if you take this labor-intensive processes. So I think my thing was, at least we need to be specific from the word go. When they are given the project, they are told that this is what you do. Because anyway, the money it belongs to the government. This is what you do. This is how. And then, when they come to do the tenders or whatever, they need to be there. We had very serious problems about the EPWP and the employment of the people with disability. They will tell you, no ways, you can't. But I think maybe we'll get there as time goes on. If we specify from the day they are given the tender. My other question is around the alien plans. In most cases, these alien plans are in privately owned land. So, how does it work? The partnership between DPW. And the how does it work? Because sometimes the money comes from the government, but the alien plans are in the privately owned land. The next one is about the. So that. The NGOs and NPOs on these EPWP projects, the government allocates the money to the NGOs, but at the end of the day, you find the people not properly paid or not paid at all. They start toying, and then who's to blame? I think it's the way to control how does the DPW plan to control the amount of money that has been given to the NGOs. Because at the end of the day, they use it as they wish. and the stipends, the people in the rural areas are paid less, and the people in the urban areas are paid more. And on page 11, you made mention of the home health and sports supervisors. Does this happen in the rural areas, or it only happens in the townships? Also, on slide number 16, it's good to hear about the monitoring and evaluation of this project. It has been a problem. Okay. Sorry, No. I'm on the last one. About the... Okay, the clarity on this, on the Presidential Coordinating Commission. How does it... I mean, what will the public works doing on this, because we rely mostly on public works. I think we know how public works, they know how to supervise, or but it was sort of clarified that they will meet once a quarter, and most of the work will be done by public works. And then just what happens to the, is it still going to be the incentive grant that is given to the municipalities, or how is it going to work? And lastly, on the National Youth Service, what has been encouraging the when we do oversight on this National Youth Service, once those the youth has been trained, maybe if there's the stadium that is going to be built, so they are given the chance to have probably the machine for working the paving bricks, or lately most of the access roads are made out of the paving bricks. I think the aim and objective is to make them the SMMEs. In the end, they mustn't be stuck, and train them even for the maintenance of some of these roads, because they will be having the machines, and they will also be selling the paving bricks to other people who need them, instead of buying from the big companies. I think that is all. Otherwise, we thank the department.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. The issue here is around the schools. You'll find that schools are being fed all over the country, but you find some being fed, the others are not getting feeding at all. We do not know the reason. Maybe there's some grading of schools or what. Because you find that there is a white or a colored school or an Indian school next to the black school. The black school doesn't have a feeding scheme, but all other schools have got feeding scheme. The same thing applies to the security. You'll find that the black school has got no security, whereas the other schools, different races, they've got security. I think there is a problem. There's something needs to be done there. And number three, NGO and CBOs. You will find them that they are operating, but their operation is limited. You find them that they are in urban areas as well as in township. You hardly find them in the rural areas. We do not know the reason as to why are they not spreading and do the same job in the deep rural areas. The last one, monitoring and evaluation. I still doubt that those people are doing their job properly. You'll find that corruption is escalating, and I do not know whether they are part of it or what. Because if they are doing their job properly, I think they would have reduced the number of corruption that is taking place all over the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Mahogovan. Thank you,
Chair. I want to thank the
Yeah, mic is not on. Balmagovan, can you please use your mic?
As he went along with the presentation, I jotted down
on Gabby, I think you are comfortable in Afrikaans. The minister, the deputy minister, does understand Afrikaans.
Okay. So, die presentation, soos die hierdie presentation het, notas gemaakt, en is het ook notas gemaakt. Voor mij die belangrijkste het, by die laatste slide in die gekom, waar meer antwoorden, of moeilijke antwoorden naar voren komen. Dit is die vraag wat ons heet, kan intercollimering ways, vooral bij jou see, bij jou community works program en non-profit organizations, waar altijd een toets is, of mensen kunnen betalen, en dit is weer strijks en zo aan, so mismanagement of funds in die geval. Dan die ander groot ding wat ek moet elke keer ophaal, die selection of workers based on clearly defined process en criteria. Voor my is het crucial dat daarvan vooraf een criteria moet wees kreden, berus nie onder op die grond die municipaliteit of die CPW doen sy aanskering so en die een doen sy aanskering so nie, want dit is waar die grootste probleem in gemeenskap is. Die program se befondsing kom ons van ons allemaal belastingbetalers. So allemaal in die land het die reg om op een gelijke kant werk te kry, en dit is ongelukkig nie die geval. So as die aspekte aangespreek dat is van die programma wat 100% werk. Die adult education, early childhood, school feeding, die home-based care, werk wonderlijk. En daar sien jy nie so baie van politiek of ons kyk na die gesin, wie ons aanstel, is werkelijk een goed program en daar is opleiding aan verbonden. Maar daar is by maar al hierdie community works programs is dit die probleem. Een probleem wat ons opgetel het met ons, ek was nou net in die proefing in die komitee met die besoek in die Weskamp, was die disparities rondom disabled people. Daar is nie voldoende disabled people wat mense sê elke keer, maar dat die probleem of die probleem ook wat hulle moet respond as hulle net een disabled persoon. En ek vind dit is nie aan paard, want weet, oor al ons gemeenskap wat is, waar die disabled mense afgesteed. So, met hem sê, ek is baie gelukkig met die presentation, en as die laatste wijse, as se punte werkelijk uitgeleef gaan word, voor een punt by streek, dan het ek nie een probleem met die program. My, die ding wat elke keer oor selection, oor disabled voor die cijfers en so. Ek is happy met die voorlegging en die pad aan te doen.
Thank you, Oom Jeffy. No, Auntie Marjala.
Thank you, Jefferson. Jefferson, let me join the brand work on thanking the Deputy Minister for the presentation. But I think I'm covered by previous speakers, Jefferson, because my concern was on the stipend, the formal employment, because you'll find that in some areas people are working there for more than 3 months, but they're not registered. So those people are not covered by the labor law and so forth. The other problem we're encountering in the communities is that there is a contractor who receives the tender. That contractor is having a subcontractor. The counselor is also involved, and the workers are suffering again because there's no clear guidance what's going to happen. I also want to say that the committee once went to Minnerton to see this where people are working on fire. It's quite a good thing which is done by the department. But we only saw that here in Western Cape. I wonder if the department cannot expand it to other provinces. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mama. We are done, Deputy Minister.
Yes, my colleagues will help me, and they must not feel sorry to correct me when I get things wrong. The beginning with the Honourable Dreyer's intervention, I think very important and useful issues that she, like all of the other colleagues, are raising. You see, I agree that it's not a silver bullet, these public employment programs, but then you went on to say it's like a band-aid. And that's where I don't agree. Okay. Because I think, and what I was at pains to try to show was that actually, not always and not everywhere, very, very significant developmental contributions and interventions are being made. You know, a significant contribution to our GDP, for instance, unmeasured very often, whether it's working for water, working for fire, and so forth. So the idea that this is just like a temporary thing, I think, is wrong. It, or just a band-aid. It can be that. And what we're trying to do, what we've been trying to do through phase two, and I think much more in phase three, is to make sure that what we're doing on the public employment front is not just a band-aid on the structural and systemic problems we've got in our economy and society, but actually contributes, not as the sole silver bullet, but as one of a number, a range of interventions that contributes to transforming the strategic, systemic problems that we've got. Okay, so now, we haven't really got time, but let's just step back a little bit from the immediate thing. You know,
I'm giving you ample time because we don't form a quorum, so we won't be dealing with the report.
Okay.
We don't form a quorum.
Okay.
So just...
Okay. The, I was just reading an interesting, the book that was a big deal at Davos recently, okay. It's called, I think, The Second Machine Age or something like that, but it's talking about the IT communication revolution. And one of the points it's making is its impact globally on jobs and what we regard as formal employment. So it uses numbers of examples, but the one interesting example, for instance, is that until about 3 decades ago, Encyclopedia Britannica, okay, was employed either directly in terms of the annual production of the new supplement and so forth, employed, I think, directly something like 30,000 people, whatever, in the sort of editorial staff and the research staff and so on. And then also there was employment, global employment, particularly in the English language world, of salespeople and so on, selling Encyclopedia Britannica. It's gone, Encyclopedia Britannica. Wiped out by Wikipedia. Wikipedia apparently has something like 100 times or 1,000 times, I can't remember exactly, but by huge multiples, much more data and information than Encyclopedia.
Not all of the data is necessarily absolutely correct, but so on.
The number of people using it is infinitesimally larger than ever had access to in a library or at home to an Encyclopedia Britannica. Wikipedia, its contribution to any country's GDP is not figured because it's all voluntary. It doesn't create any paid work, or maybe a little bit of the management of the site. I'm sure there are perhaps 100 people, if that, who are working. So this vast army of employed people in formal sector jobs have been displaced by something that is incredibly useful, incredibly accessible. So it's a huge contribution to knowledge, to usefulness, to it's an asset. But it's not a job creator. Okay. And one could go on and on saying how it's not just our apartheid, obviously it's our apartheid past and our whole history in South Africa that's created this very problematic economy that doesn't create jobs, that is exports, you know, things, does things either, anyway, I won't go on and on because this is not the thing, but we agree. But we're now in a world in which also there's a massive displacement of formerly employed working people. And yes, there are large numbers of people doing useful work, but it's in the case of Wikipedia, it's voluntary. So I want us to think of what people are doing, for instance, in poor communities in South Africa. It's not formal work necessarily, but
the young women that you talked about, I don't know whether they're on stipends or not in their public income, but they're going out into the community and providing a real desperately needed service to that particular community. We think of church organizations and other religious organizations in the country doing amazing things, keeping, you know, none of that features in the GDP count. So what we mean by real work and useful work, because all the people employed in the frigging advertising agencies, it's a multi-billion rand thing here in South Africa, trillions of other things, is that useful? They say, no, they're helping us to understand market choice and so on. I don't believe that. So what is real work? And what is useful work? And is it, having the privilege of being, now becoming a communist here, is it having the privilege of being exploited by a capitalist? Is that real work? And other forms of useful work, not real? Okay, so that touches on an ideological debate, which I won't get into here. But I'm just, all I'm saying for the moment is that don't pass off the public employment program as just band-aid. Okay. They might sometimes be that. But we need to have ambitions that are greater and larger than that. Okay. I also want to get too much into the Prattley example and Arbel that you mentioned and so on. But that touches on a whole range of other things. The stipend and the minimum wage arrangement in terms of the stipend and so on. But this is a complicated area which we need to be aware of. Because one of the unique things of the Growth and Development Summit, which then launched Phase 1, was that whatever one says about the trade union movement in South Africa, they agreed for there to be a massive public employment, an EPWP process, in which the participants would be paid less than they might be if they were in informal employment, in which some of the other conditions, an argument now that we're having again with the Labour Department, but for the moment we're winning it, in which the money doesn't go, part of it doesn't go to UIF and other things like that. It means that they don't have those important additional things that formal sector workers have. Because the agreement was that there's this desperate level of unemployment and we need to maximize the amount of what budget we can get for public employment programs. We need to maximize it as much as possible into getting people into the program and not then having add-ons. So if we paid them what they would get if they were in formal employment in, let me be polemical, last year the DA opposed the minimum wage for farm workers being lifted from what it was, 65 rand, which is less than the minimum wage in the public employment program, opposed it because it would lose jobs. It's now 105. They were asking for 150 rand. You'll remember the workers' strikes. Okay. National government introduced 105 rand. DA opposed it on the grounds that there would be job losses and wanted it to remain at 65 rand. Now, I'm not saying that there are not complications in this area. We're not picking up any job losses, by the way. And these are temporary jobs as well because they're seasonal workers, right? And they're by and large, the majority of them. So I just want to, I think we need to have a sensitivity to the challenge here. Unions, and why wouldn't they, who want to campaign and struggle for basic rights. And I mean, they fought for them in difficult circumstances and have won UIF, the right to strike, bargaining, the centralized bargaining and collective bargaining in many key sectors, and they set particular wage rates and so on. And there's some challenges there because often those are negotiated with big companies, and smaller companies then battle to pay what has been negotiated at a collective or centralized bargaining and so on. So they're all areas of challenges. But so I don't want to get into all of that, but I just want to make the point that we're lucky that we still have the support of the unions for these public employment programs. And we need to understand the problem, because the danger is that municipalities will be tempted to say, right, we don't want the hassle of
formal sector employees, organized by some or whatever. What we're going to do is jobs that should be municipal jobs, we're going to turn them into expanded public works jobs and pay the people 67 rand a day, money for jam. So we need to make sure that what we're doing on the public employment program isn't ironically undermining formal sector jobs. And that's a complicated space. We need to understand that. There is the danger that that Prattley, maybe that's unfair to Mr. Prattley, will employ Arbel as part of the public employment program and pay him 67 rand, when in fact it's a job that should be paid at the growing rate or negotiated rate and so on. So I don't want to go on and on, but just to alert us to the sensitivity and understand the union predicament and the very interesting thing that they're supportive of us, but we can't take that for granted. We need to keep making the case that we're not displacing formal sector jobs. But are we? Sometimes maybe we are. And so it's an area that needs care. I'll ask later on for my colleagues to answer the National Youth Service thing. I think they're a little bit more on top of it than I am. So some of the Presidential Coordinating Commission, which Honourable Dreyer raised, I think that's a very good question. And it's an issue, again, that certainly I know the DA has been raising in Parliament generally, is that when things get located in a presidency, they start to escape, because there's no portfolio committee for the presidency. So whether it's the budget for the presidency or what's going on in the presidency, it's hard for Parliament to get a handle on it. And I agree that that's a problem. But you see, it's a problem. I mean, we're suggesting this not in order to escape parliamentary oversight, but I think Parliament must develop protocols and ways of meeting as well to meet the challenge. Because ideally, when we're talking about the public employment programs in phase three, we shouldn't be meeting chairperson just as the Department of Public Works or the Portfolio Committee on Public Works. There's a number of questions, for instance, were asked about what is the department doing on working for water or working on fire, and what do we employ people out of the Western Cape, was your question. Well, in fact, it doesn't fall under our department at all. It falls under the Department of the Environment, okay, and they're running really good public employment programs. So it would be very nice if we were meeting in a committee in which we were sharing ideas and challenges which involved environment, for instance, which is a very important department, but there are a number of other departments also that are important. So we need to find parliamentary ways of oversight and monitoring, both in Parliament and, of course, outside of Parliament as well. And I think that that's a task. So Parliament needs to rise also to the challenges of Phase 3 and what we're trying to do in Phase 3. Okay. But just to reassure colleagues that the fact that the Department of Public Works will be the secretariat for this presidential would be that this committee would still remain the prime committee for reporting in on progress and so on. So we would still be using it, and you would need to, I mean, the parliamentarians in this committee going forward would need also to use that fact that the key keeper of the statistics and oversight would still remain technically this department. But ideally we would meet in a different way going forward. Okay. The branding, again, I think yeah, absolutely there's always the danger. So what we don't want to do is take away the existing branding of working for water, working on fire, to use those examples for Kapila and so on. So they should remain. But what there isn't is a kind of common sense of a family of public employment programs. And the word EPWP is partly problematic, partly because people think that all the projects therefore fall under public works because of the coincidence of the name Department of Public Works and the kind of public works program, and because we've been the sort of lead department, but by far not the only department. So what we're looking for is some kind of branding, and maybe it's just public employment programs,
so that there isn't a confusion that everything that is a public work is ours. And so on. But we do want to keep the individual personality of different projects as well, some of which have done very well in branding themselves. But we can help that branding by connecting it to a wider family of initiatives. So I hope that answers the question, which I think is a correct question. The disability issue, I think it's something that we've not resolved effectively. You know, maybe, now, what's it called? There's a program. There are programs which are specifically disability programs in which there's a stipend which is larger than our 67 rand a day stipend. There are workshops, for instance, for the blind and so forth, which are run out of social development, if I'm not wrong. And maybe we should again make a connection there. So it's unrealistic to think that. Well, maybe it's unrealistic. Also, when we talk disability, we think someone in a wheelchair, someone who's blind, or someone's deaf. But obviously, disability is a lot of different things. It's many, many different things. But it might be unrealistic to expect a high percentage of disabled people, whatever the disability might be. But, I mean, it might be a mental disability, for instance.
What about spectacles? Is that not disability?
It's a serious disability, I promise you, particularly when they're bifocals.
Yes.
but we can't seriously, but obviously that isn't what we mean. And obviously we mean people that are batting to be employed otherwise because of some form of disability or other. Otherwise, it might be a physical or mental disability or whatever. And I think it's an area we need to think about, whether the targets are realistic. I think it's a 2% target. And whether we don't scale up in some dedicated areas where you can achieve, across the program you can get a 2% disability, but every single project might be unrealistic if it's, complicated, if it's not complicated, if it's construction work, for instance. Someone with mental disabilities might be able to, in depending if it's not heavy lifting or in a dangerous situation or whatever. So I don't know, but I think it's a good question that was asked, and I think we've been too mechanical, and maybe we ought also need to think about the social development programs that are run in any case, weaving and so forth, which I think are a little bit in disrepair, some of those things, if I understand correctly. So, nice question, and I think we need to be thinking more seriously about it in a different way. On an alien invasive, I think my colleagues might correct me, but you're right, much of the alien invasive vegetation is on private property. Okay. Now, in terms of, I think it's the National Environment Management Act, the NEMA Act, if there's alien invasives on your property, you are legally bound at your cost to remove them. There's so much of it, and no one is particularly doing it, although we are encountering farmers and so on who want to see the invasives gone, who are serious about the environment, or who can see that the invasives are wiping up their pasture, their grazing land, or wiping up their water resources and so on. And so there are nice partnerships between Working for Water and a private property owners, and the program is basically funded, but I think assisted through funding and so on, if I understand correctly, through private owners. A lot of the invasive clearing happens on public land, in nature reserves, in water resources and so on, in mountainous areas and so forth. So it's a combination of things. But you're right, a lot of it is on private land, and a lot of the worst stuff is just not being dealt with, and we're not tough enough on the Environmental Management Act. There was a question about when it's a non-profit organization is the sort of implementing or project managing entity, that people aren't getting paid or there are problems of one kind or another. I'm sure that happens. I'm sure sometimes it's the line department or it's us that are responsible in some form, but often it might be the non-profit organization or whatever, which is chowing the money or putting it into admin and so on. Those things happen in real life. But generally, our experience with our non-profit sector is that they're performing well, and you know, people are getting paid. But it's a question of proper monitoring, proper evaluation, proper selection of the non-profit sector, and so on. Rural stipends are less than urban stipends. The stipends that are paid vary quite a lot across programs and so forth. And as I say, we even find examples where people are paid less than the legal limit, and that must be rooted out. But we don't want to sit in upper limits. We want to allow flexibility. You know, for instance, with firefighters in the Working on Fire program, that's highly skilled, highly trained. There's a lot of expectations on them. It requires a high level of morale, and they're often on the program for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And so there's some pay progression in the thing and so on. And so they get paid not great salaries, but you know, reasonably well. In other cases, in a community work program where it's removing rubble and so on, you know, 67 rand is not great a day, but it's something. So we want to allow flexibility. And so I'm not, I think different rural projects and different urban projects, you'll see a diversity. So I don't think it's just, there's a big difference between rural and urban per se, by definition.
On the homework and sports thing, is it happening in rural areas? Gauteng has some rural areas, but it's a very urbanized thing. So the example that we're given, and as far as I know, it's not particularly happening in any other province, but we would like other provinces.
It is happening in other provinces? In the Free State. Okay. And I assume it would be, basically it would be, I'm not sure, so I can't give you an accurate answer, but overwhelmingly these, we were talking about township schools. But obviously there are townships in rural areas as well with schools that do need assistance. But I don't know if my colleagues have got their fingers on detail, but certainly in Free State, I'm reassured that it's happening as well. But the reason why we're sort of trying to popularize it is we think that all the provinces should do it. It's needed in many cases, and it's a useful thing. On the school feeding thing, which is also a related question, you know, again, you see, it's not a Department of Public Works issue. It's basically to provincial education departments that the school feeding is arranged. And if there are anomalies where neighboring schools, and I've heard about those anomalies, neighboring schools, one gets it and one doesn't, you know, why that's the case needs to be answered. But the point I would want to make around school feeding is that too often the school feeding is done, there's lots of space for localized and expanded public works type, cooperative type school feeding provisioning. And too often it's not happening. It's kind of biggest companies and biggest NGOs just buying bread from the same big producers and so on. And I think that we need certainly as public employment practitioners and advocates to try to make sure that more and more of the school feeding is locally based, creates local jobs, baking bread, making sandwiches and so on. I'm sure you'd agree.
Minister, they're no longer giving children bread. There's stipulated that schools should use certain equipment for preparing food, the stainless basins, dishes and all that. And now schools, particularly in my area, teachers are asked to go around asking for crockery, decent crockery, no longer plastic plates.
Okay.
Because I was asked to donate plates, proper plates. So things are happening.
Yeah.
I was asked to donate liquid soap for the class, the whole class, to wash their plates. So better things are happening.
Yes.
There's a standard of food that must be provided.
Okay.
Like I mentioned earlier, there's a day for beans,
yeah,
and same a day for rice and this.
Yeah.
It's no longer bread and juice only.
Okay. Until that's Limpopo, okay, and whether it's happening every week equally and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm trying to make is, what is the space for EPWP participation in preparation
of the food and so on. And it's happening in some cases, but it's uneven. And I think we need to, because it creates local jobs and a local sense of responsibility and connection to, and connecting that to food gardens, which are also EPWP. So it's making the connections, which often, and so what happens because of the structural problems in our economy is that our whole economy is so dominated by these big conglomerates, which monopolize everything. And we've got to use the EPWP and other initiatives to create many more labor-intensive local jobs, local economies, rather than just everything being supplied from the same big agro companies, baked by the same big baking companies, and retailed by the same big retail companies and so forth. Okay. I think I've tried to, I think I've sort of covered, maybe not in detail, the questions I've answered, but I think that that's telebook it or yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson NGM. I'm going to answer questions around branding. We have provided guidelines to public bodies so that they can use the guidelines so that we speak together as a family. So I know it issues around the yellow t-shirts with working for water, but most of the public bodies have complied. They are using those guidelines in terms of branding, co-branding, so they are using them. So we've provided those guidelines. And in terms of sports and caregivers, the other provinces are coming on board, and they are, you know, it's spread across rural and urban areas, but they look at schools that have not had these opportunities. It's poor schools who are receiving, you know, support in terms of sport and caregivers. Also, the support is given to the grade 3s because it was found in terms of research that children do well in grade 1, grade 2, but in grade 3 there's a dip. So you find that those matriculants that are not working are trained to, you know, offer education to these extra lessons to the grade 3. And others who are interested to become teachers then receive bursaries to further their education. So there are those opportunities for those. And we are working with the Department of Sports and Recreation around mass participation in sport, and they train sport coaches that they deploy to schools. So that's one program. It's very small, but we hope that it will grow big because we have provided incentive in the Free State, I think 3 provinces, around mass participation in sports. And also around the school feeding program, the National School Nutrition Program, is a program that's reported under EPWP. They report the gardeners and the food handlers because it's an integrated program. But feeding of schools is according to quintiles. There's quintile 1, quintile 2, quintile 3. Not all schools will be fed. It depends on the level and the subsidy. So they classify according to quintiles. And I agree with the chairperson that the food has changed because the Department of Basic Education has provided menus to the school that they need to comply to. In terms of the late payment by the NGOs, as public works, we run the NPO program, and the Independent Development Trust is our intermediary. What we do, once we have contracted the NPOs, because we do due diligence, currently the teams are in provinces going to check whether those NGOs are legit, they are still registered with the Department of Social Development, and they provide the tax exemptions because we don't want to work with fly-by-night. Once we contract them, we pay an upfront payment of 2 months so that they do not run of cash, because we've been accused of putting a burden on the NPOs, but it's only for 1 month. And then as they report, we give them, you know, we transfer funding to them. So if the beneficiaries are not paid, it's because of the NPO itself. It's not because of the late payment by the IDT. So we've engaged those NPOs because some of them are not, you know, they can be legit, but along the way, because it's money, then there are bound to be some flaws. So we are dealing with some of the flaws. We've taken others to, you know, to task regarding how they've, use the money, but it's just a small percentage, 0.something% in terms of, you know, mismanagement of funding. And the NPOs, you know, you find that it's a national NPO, but it's got satellite offices in rural areas. So we sent, they appoint people from those rural areas. But ideally, we would want to have the NPOs. What we've done now, we have said we need to have an NPO in each and every district so that, you know, the services are spread across all the other districts. Going into the local space is something that we can look into, but we focus, the focus is more on rural areas, though it's a national NPO. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Audio? No, I'm not looking at, I'm saying audio.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Well, this is a very good story to tell. Yeah? EPWP? Very good story to tell the community.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to answer some of the questions, just to add a little bit to the responses. On the National Youth Service, we have a clear selection process. When we go out, we have a criteria. We're looking for grade 12, for example. We usually put out an advert in the local area. And then they go through an assessment where they do just for maths and English. There's an assessment process to go through because of the training that goes through. So we try to make it as transparent as possible. The advert is done in the area where the project shall be because it depends on departmental projects as we roll it out. In terms of the exit strategy for the National Youth Service, we do have three main strands in terms of exit for the youth. The first one is that we try to give them further training. Maybe we may link them up to an FET college so they can continue training because the 1 year that they get in NYS is not enough to make someone an artisan. And then some of them, we've been able to put them on artisan programs where we've got funding from NSF, for example, National, where we've been able to skills fund. For example, we've trained about 90 learners from the Northern Cape in artisan training, and some of them have qualified as artisans. And those are an exit from the NYS. The other strand in terms of exit is we would link them up with the contractors. Some of the contractors retain the learners because they've been working on a project on site. Some of them are very good. They are retained on the project and the contractor then absorbs them as part of his staff so that they can continue growing through. And then some of them, we agree with the comment that was made. We're also trying to push them into SMMEs. We want to do a lot more there, that we could organize them into co-ops, depending on the skills they've learned in terms of the artisan training. So those are the three stands we have in terms of the exit strategy for NYS, and we do monitor that, say how many youth. We're targeting 15% for now. We want to target more, so that 15% of those who've trained, who've exited, we need to have them placed and then to monitor them. So something like with all the comment made about the youth being trained into making of materials, paving bricks, to fit certainly within the SMME part of it. In terms of the private companies, we one of the things we want to emphasize now is the compliance to the guidelines in terms of infrastructure. So to be very specific, to say if you get the project, you must do it in the labor-intensive way. And these are the specifications that you need to follow through, and we monitor that. So we're working with public bodies as we support them so they can mainstream their contracts with EPWP clauses. So that's very, very specific about that. Those are, I think, the questions. I think my colleague answered the question about the co-branding that we don't want to take over. In terms of we have a branding CI which allows for a public body to co-brand, to say, if they're doing EPWP, they own it also, and their logo is there. It's not public works only logo on the contract. I think those are the main questions that are coming through. Just the additional questions. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I think we need to close this meeting.
Deputy Minister, as a portfolio committee, Honourable must remember, we went to the Western, to the Northern Cape. We were taken to a disability project where parents in the morning, there's a buzz in that project, where parents in the morning take their children, disabled children, to that project. They are taught how to dance, how to do whatever they are expected to do, and they are collected in the evening. A very good project. In the same province, there's a project where they make memory sticks out of alien plants. And those memory sticks are exported internationally. In the Free State, there's a waste management project. To remember, on the members, a very, very good project. And we appreciate, in the Western Cape, there's a traffic water, a very good project also. We need to talk about, we need to appreciate, and we need to acknowledge. Deputy Minister, do you know that 2 weeks back, in my area, there's a school where they have a group of people who specially are there for cleaning toilets, refreshing toilets, putting in a toilet rolls. I knew about this because a teacher took a freshener to go and refresh his car. That's where the whole thing came out. That's where I knew about it. To say things are happening, Deputy Minister, we need to acknowledge that and appreciate that, because ordinary people appreciate that. But middle class people, high class people, they don't appreciate it. They don't see anything because they don't visit those areas to go and check what's happening there. We really appreciate on behalf of our people. Every Monday and Friday, I pass on my way to the airport to Palabora. Every day there are EPWP people there clearing, you know. And we appreciate that, Deputy Minister. Deputy Minister, on that note, I'd like to say good luck with the Phase 3 public works. Yes. To say, DG, Yebo Baba, we share the number next year and appreciate that. Audio, thank you very much, Mama. Thank you very much for the good work. Let's keep it up. Let's deal with the issue of poverty. Let's not deal with the issue of inequality in this country. Tina, the disadvantage, we appreciate the 67 rand, the 80 rand, the 90 rand that our people are given. On that note, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.